Welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast number 12, The Global Threat to Democracy, a conversation with Damon Wilson. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. For the last decade, democracies around the world have been in a rut, not a simple recession. In this post-globalization world, autocrats are waging a sophisticated campaign using new dynamics around information, polarization, and technology. The tools and tactics of repression are being exported to many countries, creating a pernicious environment, a cauldron that has seen a setback in democracy. In this podcast, Damon describes the state of democracy around the world and the challenges it faces. He shares with us his belief that Madeleine Albright was right and the future of democracy is bright. He discusses the importance of nonviolent democratic movements and the intergenerational partnerships between youth and elders in the continuing regeneration of democracy. Damon Wilson, President and Chief Executive Officer of the National Endowment for Democracy, is dedicated to the growth and strengthening of democratic institutions around the world. NED is an independent, nonprofit, bipartisan, and transparent foundation that is on the leading edge of democratic struggles in some of the most difficult circumstances in the world. Damon grew up in rural North Carolina in a community with little diversity. His world changed in the third grade when his best friend became a boy whose family had fled communist Romania. In high school, one of his best friends had fled Iran after the revolution. This led to a long and distinguished career in government and non-governmental organizations. Damon received his master's degree at the Princeton University Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Prior to entering government service, Damon worked in Croatia and Rwanda after the genocide. Damon has held positions in NATO, the National Security Council, the State Department, and the Atlantic Council. And now I would like to introduce our host, Dr. John Izu and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izu, and on behalf of my co-host, Alain Gauthier, and our producer, Jim Burke, I want to welcome you to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, where we explore and dialogue about issues about the future of humanity and planet. We don't know the way forward, but together we want to try to figure it out. So thank you for joining us. Alain, I'm excited today. We have a great guest and a very important topic, which is the state of democracies and autocracies and government around the world and how it really is influencing the future of humanity. And I couldn't help but think in preparation of, there's a lot of noise about democracy today around the world, the noise about, is it actually a functional way to organize society? And yet there's probably almost no one listening who thinks that it's better than almost everything else that we've come up with. Though I do think of my friend John Moroz, who founded the East-West Institute, who asked someone in China many years ago if the French Revolution had been a good thing. And the person in China responded, "It's too early to tell." So democracy is evolving, and our guest is going to tell us and dialogue with us about some of the ways that it is. And we're thrilled to have with us today Damon Wilson, the president and CEO of the National Endowment for Democracy. Alain, anything you want to say before we get started with Damon?
Oh, I'm just very interested in the fact that this is a hot topic, both in this country and other countries. I mean, France is going through some difficult times too at this time. So I love the two speeches that I listen to from you, and we have some additional questions based on that we'll come up with. Welcome, Damon.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to it. For a podcast focused on the future of humanity and the world, I think there's nothing more important than whether that's going to be a future of freedom or not. So I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Great. Well said. So let's get into it. In a recent speech we heard you give, you said two almost contradictory things, or maybe they're both true. One was that at least in the last couple of years, there's been a waning of some democracies and democratic institutions across the world. But then you quoted Madeleine Albright, who said that this was really, the future was bright for democracy, in part because of how autocracies are acting right now. So let's get started. What is the state of democracies and democratic institutions across the globe? Are we getting more democratic, less democratic? What should we be thinking about in terms of a 30,000 foot view of where we're at with democracy around the world?
Sure. Thank you, John. First of all, I think we have to be really upfront and recognize that in many respects, democracy does feel like, and it is on its back foot around the world. That's played out by data, but I'll come back to why Secretary Albright was right. But if you think about where we are, historically speaking, the whole world has come through some cycles of history. We've called them three democratic waves. Well, we are in the middle of a rut right now. We've seen running for almost two decades, documented by Freedom House and other organizations, that have really documented sort of the data that undershows there has been more setbacks in democracies than gains globally. And you feel that when you open the newspaper, when you're looking around the world, but it's really different. That's more than that. And we'll get into it in the conversation. For me, it's not just that we're in a democratic recession. This past decade is different. It's an era of post-globalization where we've got new dynamics around information and polarization, technology. And you overlay that with what has become an authoritarian assault on democracy. So this isn't just a benign environment. How's democracy doing? We're in a knife fight, if you will, and autocrats are really waging a sophisticated campaign. So what that means is that we're in a democratic rut. It's not just a democratic recession. It's an assault on democracy. But we'll get into a conversation that tells me why I agree with Madeleine Albright. I am optimistic about the future, but I am not complacent.
I wonder if we can start, Damon, with the rut and then talk about, I think, fascinating information about the assault on democracy. But let's start with the rut. When you say democracy is in a rut around the globe, what does that rut look like? Why do you think we're in a rut? And we'll get to the assault, but what's the rut that's going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, we have to start with looking at the reality in established democracies where we see an uptick of bouts of populism and deconsolidating democratic institutions, challenges to norms. This is an issue across the world. You hear this as a big conversation among Americans, but the truth is it's an issue that permeates many democracies around the world. And so when you have the core established democracies wobbly, what does that mean for the rest of the world and on the periphery, if you will? And it has implications. But at the same time, we've also seen an incredible sharpness of repression coming from autocratic regimes that have learned lessons of using of violence and how to marry that with domestic repression to control their own populations, producing incredibly large numbers of what you can call democratic diasporas. Look at the number of people that have fled Belarus, Russia, Myanmar, Venezuela, both refugees and traditional refugees, but very much these democratic diasporas as authoritarian regimes repress and push out those that are the forces of democracies in their country. But it's not good enough to just control their populations at home. What we're now seeing in this globalized world is the export of the tools, technologies, and tactics of repression as they go global and they back each other up. And this is exacerbated by an environment in which information incentivizes an information environment that can be manipulated with disinformation, incentivizes polarization, a technology environment that, whether it's artificial intelligence or face recognition, that the autocrats can use to crack down on dissidents and track political opponents. And you overlay this with a much more sophisticated network of protecting financial resources. And it's usually autocrats protecting their wealth, the wealth that they steal from their own people, often using international mechanisms and free societies to protect their kleptocratic wealth. It's corruption on a state scale that is enormous. And when you put this together, it's created a pernicious environment, a cauldron that has really seen a setback in democracy. And it's been played out in the numbers and successes of democratic transitions. I can get into that if it's useful, but I'll stop with that.
Damon, in your recent presentation at the John B. Herford Memorial Lecture, you identified two phenomena that I'm guessing some of our listeners are not familiar with. And you spoke about what you called Autocracy Inc. and sharp power, the use of sharp power. Brian Finley, who you may know at this from the Stimson Institute, a previous podcast, talked about the United States historically perhaps using more hard power than and not enough soft power. But share your thoughts on this Autocracy Inc. and the use of this sharp power that many citizens may not be aware is going on around the world, this assault on democracy.
Sure. So it's no surprise that despots and dictators have supported each other throughout history. But what we've seen in a more globalized world is really this phenomenon that Anne Applebaum has really written so eloquently about, Autocracy Inc., driven by deals, not really ideals. And it's a way in which it is the export tools, tactics, technologies that autocrats back each other up, sharing and coaching each other. Will Dobson, the editor of our Journal of Democracies, published a book, The Dictator's Learning Curve. And for example, we saw the police in Belarus faced with a mass protest when the government, when Lukashenko tried to steal, or he did steal the election, mass protests that probably if they had happened in the 90s would have led to a democratic transition. But what did we see happen? We saw Belarusian police coached by Russians on boa constrictor police tactics to not provoke a confrontation, a bloody crackdown, but to squeeze, to pluck out individuals, to target the repression against certain leaders, and to squeeze the popular resistance. And over time, then use things like facial recognition technology to go back and track down those who were participating. We even saw Russian propagandists take over Belarusian news media during the height of the crisis to help manage the information war, if you will, because they actually couldn't rely on their own Belarusian voices and journalists who were had doubts and wanted to really side with the people, if you will. This is a new phenomenon, that a degree of coaching and supporting of each other. It's backed up by the finances to see the Maduro regime that has squandered $60 billion in loans from China, that is profiting on exchange of weapons with Russia, that has been backed up and really has a security apparatus that is run by Cuban intelligence, and that uses exports of gold, money laundering through Turkey to help solidify the Maduro regime. And so we're seeing Autocracy Inc. take the form of autocrats backing each other up. And it's oftentimes a cozy way of protecting their stolen goods or stolen money as well. Sharp power, it's a related kind of concept. Oftentimes people were tempted to fall into the trap of saying, well, the Communist Chinese Party is, this is really just soft power, or what the Russian state is doing with RTTV. This is just soft power, projecting their values, their interests. It's not. These are apparatuses of state instruments designed to undermine democracy and really to advance particular interests. And so our team here, Chris Walker and some incredible researchers, helped coin this term sharp power to understand the instrumentalization of what people at one point may have understood as soft power used for sharp power purposes. And we see that in, for example, Chinese investments in a media ecosystem in Africa. It's not just about making investments in the media space. It's about controlling the infrastructure of how information flows to African people in a way that is now sanitized with pro-Beijing information. You'll see nothing about Uyghurs or Taiwan that's on those news channels as a way of really manipulating the audience. And this sharp power, we've seen it targeting free societies ourselves, is a real challenge, a new way of understanding the reality of the problems we have in front of us for democracy.
So, Damon, maybe within that global context and focusing a little more on the United States for a moment, some would argue that the United States has been selective in its support of democracy over our lifetime, at least, often supporting authoritarian regimes when it's suited to our needs, and democratic movements when it serves our interests. So we've done both. So what has changed, or is that still a fair criticism? As you mentioned, we've entered a new era for the last 10 years. So how is that affecting it?
Absolutely, this is an issue historically speaking. And why do we know that? Because of the research, the studies, the debates, the congressional hearings, the journalism, the way a free society holds its leaders to account is how you know that.
Yeah.
And we've exposed those shortcomings historically, and that's the power of a free society. It doesn't mean that a democratic government will get everything right, whether it's healthcare policy or foreign policy, but it does mean there are mechanisms to expose, hold accountable, and report. And it's why the National Endowment for Democracy, I'm privileged to lead this institution, it's a beautiful thing. And that to the credit of 40 years ago, President Reagan in Westminster address called for a support for the global infrastructure for democracy. And in the context was really facing what was considered the march of communism, really the expansionist policies of Moscow around the world, when there were fewer than 60 free societies on this planet. And thank goodness a group of Americans that were organized got backing from the U.S. Congress to stand up this vision as the National Endowment for Democracy, as an independent institution, but yet one that would be funded by the American people through the U.S. Congress. And to do it in a way that it wasn't subject to the vagaries of an administration policy, whether it was left or right, whether it's Obama or Trump, it was going to be an institution that was singularly focused on support for democracy and freedom around the world. And so we have that privilege of being responsible stewards of funding from the American people, but singularly focused on support for democracy and freedom around the world. Now, at the same time, and I think this is part of a mechanism to say, look, you know, we recognize, and at the time, 40 years ago, there were leaders in American civil society and labor and business, there were Democrats and Republicans in Congress that had this sense that, yes, our fundamental interests are served with support for the best of American values and backing the idea of these universal values around democracy and freedom, and had the sense to set that up in an institution like the endowment, recognizing the shortcomings of American strategy and foreign policy during the Cold War. At the same time, part of my argument today is that the support for other people's aspirations to determine their own future is probably the most cost-effective national security strategy you could imagine. And that's not always a popular idea. People don't always agree with that. It's certainly not one I argue. And I think many people understand that the things that we have to spend our money on or that we stay awake worrying about at night, they actually go away when we are dealing with democratic societies. Yes, we'll have spats with our allies and friends. We see that all the time. But they're kind of normal spats, if you will, not existential challenges or real challenges to the way of life or security of our people. And so this is something that is really precious that Ned can steward this in a way that is a real, I think, a national treasure for the American people. But at the same time, we're part of the battle of ideas to help others understand why this is all, supporting our values. It is in our interests.
As you were speaking, Damon, one of the things we've heard you say in other interviews is that democracy is self-correcting. And as imperfect as it is, it tends to self-correct over time. But you made a couple of points here that I think are worth digging into. One is, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that healthy democracy depended on an informed public. And so one of the things you alluded to is not just Autocracy Inc., but maybe all kinds of people all over the world using misinformation to undermine democracy. And as you said, things like questioning elections goes into that too. And, you know, when you question whether an election is legitimate or when you hear information, you don't know if it's true or not. Or as you said, with AI, it may even be Damon saying something he didn't say down the road, or Alon and John, or the president even. So talk a little bit about why it's so important that democracies have this self-corrective mechanism. And you made a really interesting point as well in one of your talks, that violent protests in particular are often used by autocrats to undermine democratic institutions. So you made a really important point that nonviolent protests tend to help democracies self-correct, but violent ones are often used by autocratic forces to undermine democracy. So let's just say a little bit about some of those things.
Sure, John. And maybe in two baskets. I mean, the first one, look, if you're a parent worried about their kid, if you're a student trying to find their way, this can feel destabilizing, a bit of a scary environment. The truth is that the amount of access of information, the amount of individual liberties that people have, historically speaking, is pretty expansive right now. It means we should not be satisfied. Oh my gosh, we've got problems. And what's really significant is that people that are alive today are going through the greatest rate of change in their societies that we have seen historically speaking. It's exponentially higher rates of change than human beings in their existence have had to experience. And so can that feel uncertain, destabilizing? Of course it can. Does that sometimes make people go back to wanting to own their roots, their community, more traditional culture and values? Of course, to hold on to something that's the certainty. And so on this one hand, there is an incredible aspect to this access to knowledge. Think about what your kids can learn and questions they can get answered, how they can understand how people are living around the world. I mean, part of the dissatisfaction we see around the world that people know that, gosh, you're living a lot better than I am. And I can see this so easily through social media today. And yet we got to figure it out as societies. Wow, what's the right regulatory frameworks? How do we actually put democratic safeguards on this? We've got to work through those things. And so that's a little bit of the first part of this, to understand it can be a destabilizing environment where it can be a conducive environment for those that want to provide easy answers, populists, those that want to play games and try to put out the siren song of easy solutions to some of these problems. The second part of what you asked is really interesting. We've got incredible research that shows really from 1900 to about 2006, tracking all the resistance movements or democratic movements around the world, those that were nonviolent were the majority of the time successful and leading to democratic transitions. I think it's really like 51, 52% looking at the historic database. Those that used violence were much less successful. I think maybe in 26% of the time. And then if you look 5 years out, those that were nonviolent had a much higher likelihood of a democracy still being in place. Those transitions that were violent, it fell to 6% 5 years out were likely to be democratic. So the correlation between violence and democratic societies is big. And that's why whether it's Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi, they were onto something. It's about sustainability of democratic transitions. Now, what's really worrying is that since 2006, these numbers have begun to change. We went from a high point of democratic nonviolent struggles, have maybe 65% successful in the 90s. Now it's plummeted to 33, 34%. And in part, it's both because the autocrats have learned. They've learned how to repress. They've learned to coach. They've studied this well themselves. And so they have become more willing to resort to violence to prevent defectors and to not hesitate to imprison or pull a trigger on their own populations. And that makes it very, very difficult, very dangerous. And yet what we see, there's been a threefold increase in protests in the last 15 years to underscore that despite the repression and the danger, its demand for people to determine their own future, man, people are not, they're not sitting back. They're taking these risks, but the likelihood of success today is less. And that's why we are in a new era of this struggle, a new era of this fight for freedom. And we've got to innovate, learn, adapt, and back each other up. And that's why I'm so energized to be here at the Endowment, because this cannot be business as usual in this hostile climate. We've got to figure out how to support those who are brave, courageous, want to shape their own future, how to give them some oxygen and help them have some wins.
I love you said is that at NED, you're in the talent hunting business, right? To find really those forces, champions, groups who are accelerating a democratic shift. And then through your granting process, and also I'm sure you're helping them out with your brains and ideas as well. So that's a great model to find. Even in change in business, find the champions, the people who are leading, and make a bet on them. And it sounds like that's a lot of what you guys do at NED.
John, I like to call it sort of venture capital for democracy, where we're built in such a way that we can take some risks. And, you know, our grants are not huge and they're not dispositive. People sometimes think, oh my God, Ned is orchestrating X, Y, and Z. Our whole model is there's no strategy written in Washington about the future of democracy in country X. We look to the people of that country. We listen to them. And we are a demand-driven institution. We don't put out requests for bids and proposals. people come to us and say, here are our ideas. Here's what we want to do. We need some support. And it becomes a question of, do we just stand on the sidelines or do we lean in to give them support in their struggle with their ideas and their approach? Because I think as people can appreciate, imposing from democracy on the outside, no way. That's not sustainable. It's not authentic. It's not about how democracy works. What we want to do is help support democratic actors in their own countries, nurture and grow this in a sustainable way where it's their agency and their struggle. And so for us, this whole work is about relationships. It's about understanding people that are really effective and really driven by these principles rather than project management or grants management. I mean, sure, we've got to worry about budgets and things like that. But the real point is these relationships of trust and supporting some of the most courageous, inspirational people around the world in their own struggle, in their own agency.
And Damon, from that perspective, with all the changes that have taken place in the last few years, how do you see the role of young people and what can be done vis-a-vis young people who may be sometimes perplexed or go to inactivity and passivity in front of what is happening?
You know, it's really interesting. There's a little bit of a conundrum in that I see and see such energy, ingenuity, and demand from young people who are not waiting for permission, but are on the front lines of democratic change. You've seen this in the NSARS protests in Nigeria. You've seen this in the United States. You see young people playing catalytic roles in social movements. And yet, their social movements don't always win. But oftentimes what you'll see is while they might feel frustrated as young activists, they often have moved the goalposts. They've moved the entire place of position of a debate in society. And they might not have attained their maximalist objectives, but they may have made things possible for reformers in government that hadn't been possible before their social movement. It may not go far enough for some activists, but it actually can have a systemic impact on moving the society forward. And frankly, that's how change happens in democratic societies. The fact that many young generations are unsatisfied, they see inequality, they see lack of representation, they see a lack of justice and want to do something about it. That's actually what makes governments have to respond, be accountable, and it moves societies forward, often not at the speed that satisfies young generations. But the conundrum is that we do see across the world historically low voter participation rates by young people. And they often lead social movements, but do not turn out in mass to exercise the vote to deliver on that. And that's where I think how to marriage the energy, the ingenuity, the enthusiasm, harness that with the technology that young generations can help drive forward and use that to help shape that they're going to have a seat at the table in shaping democratic norms for technology. They're going to use their vote to actually put people in office that respond to their concerns and needs. And I think that's one of the big challenges out there. We look to next generation to provide that energy. But I think understanding that fighting outside the system gets you so far, fighting inside the system gets you so far, and having that nuanced approach, how can you channel that energy so that we see higher rates of participation among young people, whether in Nigeria or the United States?
And do you see any positive role of elder people in encouraging younger people to be in that place of the situation as we have it now?
Absolutely. I am a big believer in what we call intergenerational strategies. And so we help support things like the World Movement for Democracy, where you will have extraordinary leaders who carried the torch and the fight for freedom in their societies and now are iconic leaders. And then you see people who are in the middle of their career, who are at the heart of making decisions today. And then you see sort of the next generation coming. And so we marry that concept of an intergenerational strategy in our fellows program. We have Hereford Youth Fellows that are the next generation of activists around the world doing remarkable work. But we connect them with people like Maria Ressa, who chairs our world movement and is an incredible journalist fighting for truth, fighting for facts, fighting for how to manage the algorithms so that they can have democratic basis rather than division. Or Jose Ramos Horta, a revolutionary leader, a leader that brought democracy to East Timor. And we often see where the help can be is in this concept of crossover. How do you go from being an activist, a democratic advocate, and crossing over into the responsibility of governance? And this is a huge challenge and crisis, whether it was in the failed transition we're watching unfold in Sudan, the challenge of that transition in a place like Tunisia, the successful transitions in Moldova and Zambia. It is very uncomfortable for people who have been rabble rousers on the street sometimes, or activists or labor organizers. All of a sudden, now they've got responsibility of governance and how to deliver, how to now build coalitions, how to reach a compromise to get a majority vote in a parliament. And so that's where we see really valuable opportunities for people to learn from each other and their experiences. And this is a real antidote. It's not as if Ned or American show up and say, hey, here's how we do it. That's not the point. It's bringing people together to learn from successes and failures together. And that's where the intergenerational strategy is invaluable.
You know, one of the things that kind of raises for me, Damon, is really the question of how does democracy have to evolve? You know, Jeremy Rifkin, in his most recent book, The Age of Resilience, he has a chapter on representative democracy. And one of the things he talks about is the phenomenon of distributed bureaucracy, of local governments beginning to enlist citizens in peer assemblies, working alongside government, providing guidance, counsel, and recommendations related to governance of their biosphere. It makes me think of a politician, an internet company venture founder from Buenos Aires, who I met at The Hague a few years ago, who ran in Buenos Aires. He lost, but his party was called the Internet Party or something like that. And the whole idea was they wanted to reimagine a direct democracy through almost virtual town halls, where the government would literally be more immediately almost going back to New Hampshire, you know, and town halls, virtual style. I'm curious, any thoughts you have on how democracy has to evolve? So, you know, Jefferson said you needed another revolution about every 20 years, by which he meant democracy itself would have to evolve. What's some thoughts on how you think democracy, what's the edge of how democracy itself may have to change? I know that's a big question.
No, I mean, to be honest, I think that is the requirement for democracy's success, that it be a living, breathing organism that is shaped by an engaged citizenry that is present in the time of its existence. And so it's actually why I am confident over the long term and optimistic about democracy, because it's got this ability to be shaped, reformed, adapt, because it's got to be responsive to the demands of people, which is not what happens in autocratic systems that only have to listen to a clique or a few individuals. And so I think it's really important to recognize that democracy is not the silver bullet that guarantees outcomes. Democracy doesn't mean you have great healthcare policy or extraordinary fiscal policy or the best foreign policy. It does mean that you've got a say. You've got a say in helping to shape that. And I think the reformist tradition, which is so strong in the United States, but it's actually built into the concept of democracy being responsive to people, holding leaders accountable. And so what do we have? Debates over ranked choice voting, debates over political party financing, debates over how we define congressional districts. Good. Good. This is part of renewal. This is part of how do you consider to make democracy more representative? I mean, just to have a cursory understanding of American history, to understand our struggle with representation. Sometimes I hear people say, my God, we're in such a bad place. Until you actually understand American history and you understand the evolution of our struggle towards equality and inclusion and justice and representation. And then it gives you a little bit of perspective. But that doesn't just happen. It's not handed to you. People have to go out and make their systems accountable. And so I think it's a really healthy thing. How can technology help us? How can innovative ideas, ranked choice voting, how can these things really reshape the vibrancy so that people say, okay, I'm dissatisfied, I'm unsatisfied. And that unsatisfaction is what channels a self-correcting mechanism. And it doesn't mean we always get it right, but it means you've got license to experiment. And it means that one or two individuals don't have a veto over that.
Yeah, and I was thinking about, Bernie Sanders, love him or hate him, probably half the audience loves him and half hates him. You know, when he said we need a revolution, if you dissect what he really was saying is after the election, the citizens have to be involved all the time, right? Otherwise, it doesn't work. And I hear you talking about that. And I wish we would have more discussions, not about who's right or who we're voting for, but how we actually renew the democracy. And that kind of maybe gives us a chance to turn the camera back to the U.S. Alon, why don't you give Damon a chance to look at our own democracy?
What is the state, in your view, what is the state of democracy in the U.S. now? As John just said, looking at it from the outside, what would the observations be and where are we, in which stage are we of maybe a transition to something else?
I guess a couple of things. First of all, let me just say that the National Endowment for Democracy is supported by Republicans, Democrats, business, labor, those who disagree vehemently sometimes about policy issues in the United States. They actually come together to support the endowment and to support these ideas and these values, the best of American values, the universal values of democratic freedoms and individual liberties overseas. And so in many respects, the endowment, which doesn't work on democracy in the United States, our contribution to democracy in the United States is by having the largest possible number of actors in the U.S. Congress to stand together to say, we might disagree with each other, but we actually understand that supporting those who are struggling for democracy around the world is something that we should stand together behind. And it's a fact. We've got really deep bipartisan support. And it actually, sitting here in Washington, you know, the headlines are all about the bad stuff, and there's some pretty difficult stuff out there. I won't deny that. But there's an amazing amount that gets done by people who really do believe in our country and believe in how we can support good efforts around the world. And the endowment's an expression of that. But I like to think about, I'm from South Carolina, I live in Charleston, South Carolina. And my city's divided two congressional districts, and one of them is Jim Clyburn, the highest ranking African-American in the House. And to hear a Black politician in South Carolina talk about the state of democracy, quoting Alexis de Tocqueville in town halls in South Carolina, it's quite something. And he argues that, look, it's not as if, as de Tocqueville argued, that Americans are the most enlightened people, the most enlightened democracy, but we have a system and a sense of engagement that allows us to repair our faults. And it's that understanding coming from Black politician in South Carolina who has seen quite an arc of evolution around inclusion, representation, and engagement politically, to understand that we've got to have that engagement to repair our faults. And so that citizen activism, I guess on the one hand, I don't want to deny we've got real challenges. We've got to figure out money in politics. We've got to figure out why some people vote, don't vote. There are lots of issues out there, and we're having a horrendous debate about these issues. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we've gone through an era of globalization that's had a fundamental impact on how societies are organized, and we haven't quite figured it out. How does a democratic society that values constitutionally protected free speech, how should we think about what are the democratic norms and regulatory practices for an information environment, for social media? Left to its own devices, a social media environment with algorithms that can incentivize information ecosystems where you can isolate in your own communities and you can get caught in echo chambers and be given things that only you believe in. And then you find yourself in a spiral of understanding, oh, conservatives are evil, evil liberals are evil. And you've got an information environment and an ecosystem that really doesn't force you to understand or hear those other perspectives. Well, that's kind of a problem. That's challenging for democracy. And that's what we're seeing right now. And so, okay, well then, what do we do? How do we regulate? That's a debate we're having right now. It's the right kind of debate to be having because it doesn't just happen. We can't be complacent. We've got to think about the caliber and quality of that engagement. But it is why I guess I still have confidence over the long term, because it doesn't mean we always get this right. We're not going to make mistakes. Of course we will. But we have these opportunities to sort of argue about it, try to research it, debate it, understand it, and ultimately land in a way that I hope will over time make this country more representative of its people. And it's a challenge out there, but one that I'm proud that my job is to make sure that whether you're in the Freedom Caucus or the Progressive Caucus, that you understand why it's really valuable for the American people to support democracy advocates, freedom fighters around the world.
Good to hear that the support is still, you know, these years later. One might wonder, If NED could be born in a bipartisan way today, I'd like to hope it could be. But it's great to hear that it still has the level of support that it does. Damon, we like to have individuals who listen to our podcast think about what they can do. So, and you know, many of them live in the United States or Canada, most of our listeners. What can we do individually and collectively to regenerate our own democracy? If you were to say to someone, do this, do these couple of things to do your part to regenerate, not your side of things, but to regenerate the democracy itself, what would you say to people?
Look, I think the secret sauce of democratic systems is an engaged citizenry. And so I think taking the responsibility of being a citizen seriously and understanding that the beauty of a democratic system is that we don't have subjects. We don't have people have to sit back and wait to be, whether it's a monarch or a communist dictator, we don't need to be subjects. And it requires taking some responsibility and some agency, and not just for identifying the problems, which is a healthy part of a democratic exercise, but really trying to figure out the responsibility for solutions. And what I find the strength of the United States is that this happens in communities every day. And to see how civic groups, faith-based groups, become part of problem solving in communities, of building the social fabric that helps deal with whether it's racial issues or hunger issues or immigration, whatever it might be. It's one of the incredible richnesses. And it's the idea of a free society in the United States. What's a free society? It means the government actually doesn't have to tell you everything. And that's why our economy booms, because we have entrepreneurs that can create ideas. And it's why our civic life can be really beautiful. It's why Ukraine today has stood off Russia, because average people all across Ukraine in doing ordinary things produced extraordinary outcomes. They understood, they took agency, and they didn't just sit back and wait for the authority on high to do X, Y, and Z, but they understood that they could be involved. And you saw, you know, a long tradition in Ukraine, sometimes despite poor political leadership, of an activated population that had gone through several popular protests with engaged civil society, decentralized governance, where mayors took on important roles. And it was this structure of an engaged population that said, we're not going to cede our country's sovereignty and just roll over as Russia pours in. And you saw an all society response. And it's that understanding that the agency of an individual in your society is not to wait to be told always, it's actually to own that a little bit. And I think that's really beautiful. That's what makes American communities fun and enriched. And I think it's the best traditions that we can build on today, where we do have a lot of challenges and problems in communities to unleash the potential of American citizens, American entrepreneurs, American workers to figure out these solutions.
As you know, we focus on regenerative conversations as a way to find a way forward. And one question we ask to every one of our guest is how do you personally try to have a regenerative life?
That's beautiful, Alan. That's beautiful. First, I think for me, really drawing on something you might be able to tell from our conversation, but I am passionate about what I do. I feel really strongly, and I feel so privileged to think of this. I don't have a job. This is part of a calling, part of a vocation. And I think to figure out what gives you strength and to be able to nurture that. I grew up as a kid without any international exposure. My parents had modest means. We weren't able to travel the world. And I grew up in the South where, you know, sort of black and white. There wasn't a lot of diversity in the communities where I grew up in rural North Carolina. And then one day, a kid who had fled, whose family had fled Nicolae Ceaușescu's Romania, communist Romania, became my best friend in third grade. And as a third grader, to begin to understand, not really intellectually, what communism or tyranny was, but to actually see what it meant for my friend and his family, and to begin to understand, I don't really get my system, and I see all these problems in my community, but we are free. And in high school, one of my best friends, whose family fled Iran after the revolution, a Baha'i family persecuted for their faith, and to see, and this is in South Carolina, and to see how this family flourishes in freedom. And it gave me a little bit of perspective, got me interested in the world to be able to travel. And so the first time I was able to live overseas was in the first year of the independence of the Baltic states, when they regained their independence after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I saw people not much older than me helping to reforge their countries, their democracies, looking to the experience of the United States, the freedom that we take for granted and enjoy, and just wanting to be able to figure out how could they ensconce this and their new systems and their new democracies. And man, that told me, we got something special going on. We got problems, but we got something special going on. And so for me, I've taken strength and helping to stand by the simplicity of how can people determine their own future? It's beautiful. In part, Alain, I saw this because I also saw the dark side. I began my career working in the Balkans, working in Rwanda right after the genocide, and where many people were trapped by the idea of ethnic conflict and ancient hatreds. I was on the ground seeing, no, these are people just like everybody. We've got divisions in every society, sometimes corrupt, evil people for political purposes, manipulating divisions in society to bloody, violent effect for their own power. That's what I saw. And it really helped center me and understand that, wow, to be privileged to grow up in a free society, but also to be able to support others in their struggle for freedom, that's awesome. And so that gives me energy because I'm inspired by those who have to take risks that I don't have to. They really have to put sometimes their life at risk to do kind of the simple things. And it is such an energizing, inspirational thing to see what people will do just to be able to have a better life for their children and to have the privilege to try to modestly help them in that effort. That's what gives me energy.
Damon, what a beautiful way to end our conversation. We could go on for hours, and all you have to do is spend a little bit of time, as you have, in countries and with people that have not had the benefit of the level of rule of law or the benefit of having a say, or even just knowing that something had just happened to you. You disappear overnight and the government is behind it, right? To realize how important this conversation really is. And thanks for reminding us that, the thing we can best do is to be engaged. And often those who have not experienced it, especially young people, demonstrate that courage. And we're asked of something much smaller to be engaged in our democracy, not the same level of sacrifice, but are we willing to do that? So a couple of things stood out to me. One is making people aware of the active assault that's going on around not only democratic institutions through misinformation and control of media in places like Africa, but also just the fact that we're in a knife fight, as you said. We're in a battle for people having a say and being able to determine their own destiny. And I've always believed all my life that you travel enough, as all of us on this conversation have, you realize all around the world, most people want what's good for their family. They want to get along with their neighbor. They want to prosper and they want others to prosper. And that's why I believe in democracy, because I think ultimately when people have a say, they don't want most of the negative things. They don't want a destroyed planet. They don't want us to be at war with each other. And thanks for the great work you're doing all around the world. The second thing that really just stood out for me is that we're going to have courage in the fight for democracy. It is a never-ending battle. There will always be people, individuals who want control to themselves and to make choices that are only in their own corrupt or sometimes evil self-interest. And so all of us have a stake in that game for the future of the way forward. So thank you again. Alain, do you have a closing word? And then I'll just thank our listeners.
I found what you said very inspiring. And you're actually modeling by what you're doing what is needed from all of us. So thank you very much.
John, Alain, thank you so much for the privilege of being on your show. Just to even the work you're doing to help ensure an informed citizenry. And to know that as questioners, you can ask the questions you want. I can respond as I want. And we're not worried about the tax authorities coming to take our organizations away or worse, imprisoning us. So thank you for what you're doing. It's a pleasure being on this show. And you're right. I think people around the world often very much want the same thing. And what we find is that people that have the chance to be in free societies and democratic societies, research shows that they're happier, they're healthier, they're wealthier, and they're more secure. And so ultimately, support for another democratic way, the spread of democracy, is a way to help ensure a more durable peace, a more prosperous world. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share some of my thoughts today.
Thanks. And we might all, and please look up the work of NED, support it. You'll see that in our show notes. I guess back to that original question my friend John Moroz asked in China, was the French Revolution a good idea? I think at least us on this call would say a resounding yes, but it's not perfect yet. Let's make it more perfect. So I want to thank Damon and Alon, our great producer, Jim, but mostly I want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us. If you like what you've heard today, please spread the word and share it with others. If you like what you heard but think we could do better or have a topic or guest that you think we should cover or encounter, please let us know. And remember, each one of us every day is helping to create the way forward. So thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you on our next episode.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Elders Action Network. Their website is eldersaction.org. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast on Podbeam.